Hi, I'm Michael from Pittsburgh.
This is Laurel from Oakland.
Hey, I'm Allison from Cincinnati.
The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like me.
You should support the show like I did.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, it's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program is the filmmaker and author Rudolf Herzog. His new book is called Dead Funny, Humor in Hitler's Germany. It's an exploration of humor in Germany before, during, and immediately after the Nazi years, including both the humor of the Nazis, of their subjects, and of their targets. Rudolf, welcome to The Sound of Young America. It's great to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, what did you know about humor in Germany before you started to investigate the subject, before you made it a target of your scholarship?
Years ago, my great aunt, who was a bit of a messy, she started collecting stuff in the war because things were rationed, and she never stopped, so in the end, her house was full of mess. And basically, when she was elderly and couldn't live alone anymore and moved away, my uncle cleared out the house, and he found all sorts of weird things in the mess, like a jam jar dated 1940, unopened. But he also found like two or three sheets of paper with printed up jokes dated like 1939 or 1940. And they were sort of anti-Nazi jokes, you know, some stuff, I think, about the miracle weapon. You know, the Nazi propaganda was into this at the end of the war, that there was some sort of miraculous weapon that could turn the war. And there were, of course, the V1 and V2 rockets. But there was also V3, according to this, which is a submarine with a rubber coating, which could erase England by going around. And there was also a 500-man tank. But with only one man inside, 499 pushing. And then there was the V1000, which is a white rag which you wave when the Red Army approaches. So this kind of stuff. And I sort of really wondered, I mean, did she write this? Was she some sort of secret resistance fighter or something? And then I kind of forgot about it. And later on, I made a film about the subject because it sort of popped up in a conversation with a broadcaster. And then the book evolved out of that project.
You grew up in Germany, in Berlin. What do you think Germans know about this subject? Because there were books of jokes published after the war. How do Germans who came up after this era think of the humor of that time?
Well, first of all, Germans of a certain generation would have known about this. As you said, the first books that came out after the war were collections of anti-Nazi jokes. So these were very, very widespread jokes indeed. A lot of people told them. And my grandparents' generation all knew about this. But I would say that people of my generation wouldn't really know about it.
What was humor like in Germany during the Weimar years before the Nazis took control?
Well, it was characterized by a lot of Jewish comedians. It was sort of the heyday of Jewish comedy. And there were some very good performers like Kurt Geron or Otto Walburg, who were basically most of them in Berlin. And of course, that all disappeared in the course of, the oncoming of the Third Reich. They were exiled and some of them were killed in the camps. So yes, and after that, you did have very few comedians who were outspoken against the Nazis. But of course, it had to be kind of between the lines. There was, for instance, there was Werner Fink, who was a Berlin comedian. And one of the things he did in his act in 1934, so after the Germans came to power, was that his sidekick would come up on the stage with a picture, but with a back to the audience. And people sort of guessed that it was Hitler on the picture. And he'd stumble. And then Fink would say, oh, don't topple him, don't topple him. And people would roar with laughter. But, of course, sometime they lost patience with him. And they put him in a camp in 1935. And only through lucky wheeling and dealing, he actually managed to get out again.
In the United States, the comedy of the 1920s and 30s was in large part informed by people who had come out of vaudeville, who'd come out of touring theater. And those people were often doing ethnic humor. Whether they were, you know, the Marx Brothers are doing broad ethnic caricatures that, you know, they've taken a little bit of the ethnicity out of as it translated to film, but, you know, they're doing Italian guy, Jewish guy, etc. What were the themes of this humor that was being performed in cabarets and so on in the 20s, and how were those things changed when the political climate started to change?
Well, it was mostly light comedy. And of course, America is a country of immigrants, so you do get these various flavors. When I say the Jews in Germany, I of course mean Jewish Germans. I mean, they were totally assimilated. Many of them had fought in the World War One, and so there's not this kind of differentiation you would see. Humor became more politicized after the Nazis came to power, not by the performers, but by the populace. They looked at their leadership, and there were a couple of fault lines that were immediately clear. For instance, these people didn't look like Aryans at all. I mean, the leadership. And there were lots of jokes about, you know, the real Aryan should be blonde like Hitler and as thin as Goering, who's really fat, and, you know, as handsome and tall as Goebbels and these kind of things. But sort of in the beginning, people liked to point out things they felt uncomfortable with, also like the Hitler salute. This is something that was introduced, and it's rather ridiculous. And you had to do it if you went into a public building. You had to do it, and people just didn't feel comfortable with it. And they made lots of jokes about that, like Hitler goes to visit a lunatic asylum, and the lunatics line up, and they do the salute. And he walks past the line, and all of a sudden there's one man at the end of the line who's not saluting. And he says, hey, what are you doing there? You're not saluting. Are you crazy? And he says, no. I'm the orderly. I'm not one of the madmen. So anyway, people just didn't feel comfortable with that. But these aren't really hurtful jokes. That came much later.
I want to get to later soon, but tell me a little bit about how the changes in first attitudes, then policies towards Jews changed the world of professional entertainers and comedians during the 1930s?
Well, one of the absurdities was that, of course, Jews almost immediately, a lot of them went into exile, and many of them were forced into exile. And
there's a great joke about Jews going into exile in Africa that you write in the book.
Oh, yes. This is one of my favorites. I hope I can tell it well, but it's Levi and Hirsch, who are both Jewish, are in the jungle in the Congo. And they're both wearing these kind of tropical helmets, and they're holding guns. All right. So they bump into each other, and they haven't seen each other for a long time. They say, my goodness, Hirsch, it's incredible to see you here. What have you been up to? He says, well, I've been hunting for tigers in India, and now I'm going after crocodiles here. And what about you? And he says, well, I had a snake farm in Sudan, and now I'm going after elephants. He says, well, that's interesting, but listen, what happened to our friend Bloom? And then the other one says, he became an adventurer. He stayed in Berlin. It's funny, but also sad.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's all you can do, as they say, all you can do is laugh.
Yeah, I suppose so. I think that's how I interpret much of Jewish humor, is that it's just a way to kind of deal with these horrendous things that were happening. I mean, unfathomably awful things.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the show is the filmmaker and writer Rudolf Herzog. His new book is called Dead Funny, Humor in Hitler's Germany. What did you expect to find in the humor of the late 1930s and early 1940s among the non-Jewish German population? And how did what you find compare to what you expected?
I expected to find something that was subversive. And I think a lot of these jokes appear to be subversive, but they really didn't subvert anyone. Like, for instance, Hitler, Goering, and Goebbels out on sea, and there's a big storm, and their boat sinks. Who's saved? Answer, Germany. So these kind of things. But the city where I'm from, Berlin, the Red Army had to basically go from one house to the next. They had to fight house by house. Yet in these houses where the people were telling all these jokes, I mean, it was a mass phenomenon. So it just shows you that it didn't subvert people in the way that it would actually take fear away from them to go out and actually try to kill Hitler or whatever.
I mean, there seems like there's almost an assumption that if there is humor, that humor is subversive. But you write in the book that that especially before things turned dark, but even after they turned dark, it was a humor of fondness, and to the extent that any of the humor had a point, it was jokes that were about dehumanizing the people who were being turned into the enemy.
Yes, of course, there were lots of anti-Semitic jokes. These things existed. And the Nazis even went so far as to make an anti-Semitic comedy in 1939, Robert und Bertram, the only anti-Semitic comedy to come out of the Third Reich. Basically, it's a story set in the 19th century. It's, I think, two young hobos try to save a young girl. One of them's in love with her, and she's sort of in the fangs of this Jew. And we basically go through all the nasty anti-Semitic kind of cliches you could imagine in this film. And it's served up in a way that is kind of light comedy. You don't really expect it. So it's a very diabolical way of using humor, basically, because people don't expect it, and it's funneled into their head, the poison. And it's probably no coincidence that it came out the same year as the other anti-Semitic films like The Eternal Jew and so on. So it sort of helped to pave the way for the Final Solution in the way that people just didn't care about the Jews anymore, because of what they had seen.
One of the, as you described it, essentially fictions of the post-World War II era in Germany was that ordinary citizens didn't know what was going on in the concentration camps. And in your research about humor seems to have sort of given the lie to that assertion.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, these jokes were very, very widespread, and the camps come up in the jokes. I mean, there's, for instance, one where two men meet in the street, and one says to the other, "Oh my goodness, I'm so happy to see you. I thought you were in a camp." And I said, "Well, I'm out." And the other man says, "Well, how was it?" And he says, "Well, you know, it was wonderful. I mean, we had coffee in the morning. They served us eggs. We did some sport. There was an elaborate lunch. And in the evening, we watched movies." A man says, my goodness, I mean, that's incredible. You know, the other day I met Meyer and he told me a completely different story." The other man says, "Yeah, well, but he's been taken back in again, hasn't he?" So, yeah, it's a sinister joke, because in a way, you see that not only did people know that the camps existed, but it's quite clear from the joke that the man has been worked into submission and that people were being, you know, tortured there and couldn't get out anymore. So, and there were many of these jokes and they were widespread. So, yeah, the generation of my grandparents claimed that they didn't know anything about this. And it's quite obviously not true.
Did you talk to anyone who was in camps about the humor that was going on there in that, you know, just absolute darkest of places?
Yes, I spoke to Coco Schumann, who was in the notorious Auschwitz band. So he was forced to play while the people were sent to the gas chamber. And he confirmed what other sources confirmed, that there was a lot of humor in the camps. That's the way a lot of Jews try to cope with the situation. In fact, there's a story about, I think, one fairly well-known German actor whose father, I believe, died in Auschwitz. And someone who was there claimed that when he entered the gas chamber, he said, well, after you, Mr. Levy, or whatever. He kind of, I mean, that's almost the darkest kind of joke you could possibly make in that situation. But on the other hand, what are you supposed to say? I mean, how are you supposed to respond to something like that? And it's quite resonant. And some of the Jewish humor, of course, is very, very dark, like two men are to be executed, and they're supposed to be shot. And then the executioner comes up to them and says, well, you're actually going to be hung after all. And then one nudges the other and says, hey, look, they don't even have bullets anymore. And, of course, it's a dark joke, and it's in a way funny, but you kind of want to cry at the same time. And what's good about it, I think, is that on the one hand, there's no hope for these two protagonists because they'll die. But there's hope for the Jewish people because Hitler's mad plan isn't working out and he doesn't have any bullets anymore. So this way of kind of making yourself hope and feel hope in spite of all these horrors is quite amazing.
What do you see as the essential roles of the humor that you learned about during this time? What do you see those roles as having been?
Well, in the case of the humor of the Jews or the German Jews, I think it's a way of coping with the horrors. In the case of the jokes I came across that Gentiles were telling, I think it's to a large extent a way of venting frustrations about what was happening. In the beginning, it was more about exposing fault lines or, you know, you were a little bit angry that some brown shirts took your job away and stuff like that. And jokes were made about that. But when the wars turned sour, people were angry and worried about that. So it was a way of venting these frustrations, and in a way that you could even argue that it stabilized the regime, because once you've kind of shrugged it off with a joke, you didn't have to pick up a gun and go after Hitler.
It feels like especially those lighthearted jokes about the leadership feel like a way of disengaging, of engaging small things so that you don't have to engage the big things.
Yeah. For instance, there are very few jokes, if any, about Himmler. And I think that's quite interesting because they feared him. And he was part of all the stuff they didn't really want to know about. You see, knowing has to do with wanting to know. If you don't want to know something, you'll never know it. So I think that's quite important, because the information about the Holocaust and what was happening was there. It could be accessed, at least to some extent. There are also jokes to prove this. In Amsterdam, there was a Jewish joke going around about the gas. I mean, there were Aschau and Kohn were the heads of the Jewish council, and they were seen as collaborators with the Germans. So there was a joke about the Germans coming to them and saying, well, you know, the Amsterdam Jews are going to be sent to the East to be gassed. And then they say, well, are you taking care of the gas, or should we supply it? So people knew about the gas. They could have known about it, but they didn't want to know.
We've got more with Rudolf Herzog after a break. He's the author of Dead Funny, Humor in Hitler's Germany. It's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter, thousands of life's little questions answered, online at ask.metafilter.com. and by VG Kids, printers of t-shirts and other merchandise for touring bands, radio stations, websites, festivals, Derby Girls, record labels, national brands, and all the rabble-rousers, hackers, and entrepreneurs in between. Online at vgkids.com. The Sound of Young America is a proud sponsor of Sketchfest NYC in New York City at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, June 8th through 11th. You can catch some of the best sketch comedy in the country, including past Sound of Young America guests, the Whitest Kids You Know, folks from Marvel Comics, and the legendary Rejection Show. You can find more information about Sketchfest NYC online at sketchfestnyc.com. Welcome back to The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Rudolf Herzog. He's a writer and filmmaker and the author of Dead Funny, Humor in Hitler's Germany. I don't know if you've ever seen this episode of Fawlty Towers, where John Cleese as Basil Fawlty is an innkeeper. And I mean, he's the premise of this program is that he's a horrible, horrible innkeeper. But he has guests who are German. And it's essentially a farce where the premise is that he is obsessed with not bringing up World War II. And, of course, just makes everything horrible at every turn. But I thought that while that is obviously a British television program, it's about something that's really significant in the aftermath of World War II, which is that... what it's about is how can you possibly move on after something that is so as horrible as that?
Yeah, I have actually seen that. It's very funny. Well, after the war in the 50s, people try to get on with their lives and they try to ignore what had happened. And that was the stance. And historians of the 1950s, the German ones, their kind of take on it was that Hitler was kind of like a demon and that he had hypnotized the Germans to do all these things using propaganda and all these very modern tools. But, of course, if you look at the jokes and, for instance, Goebbels, who was the minister of propaganda, people were saying, well, his broadcasts are like Clubfoot's fairy tales, you know, these kind of jokes. You see that people did see through the propaganda and that they weren't hypnotized at all. And of course, it's very practical to call yourself someone who was hypnotized because the person who's hypnotized is not really responsible for what he does. It's the hypnotist. So that's what you really want. But of course, that's a way of bending truth. And if you look at the humor, you see that that's just not the case.
You spent more than 5 years with this subject. How has immersing yourself in something so difficult for so long changed you?
Well, it was awful. I hated it in many ways. Yes, because it's like, you know, you have to look into the abyss. You have to kind of, you can't blink, you know. And of course, it sounds interesting and humor and stuff, and it is. But you also have to look the horrors in the face of what happened. And they're worse than, you know, anything you could ever imagine. I mean, it's just horrific. And I think I've done my part in a way. And I'm happy it's out the book and it's great. But I'm also happy that, you know, I can put it on a shelf and not forget about it, but turn to other things.
Maybe a documentary about circus acts or something like that. You're a professional magician, so maybe something about magic.
Yes, yeah, I was actually a professional magician for a couple of years, yeah.
A year or two ago, I interviewed the British satirist Chris Morris about his film Four Lions, which was a farce about a terror cell an English terror cell operating in England, an English Muslim terror cell. And it came from his experience, his years of researching the subject out of his own personal interest and reading about sort of clownish, doofy behavior on the part of terrorists and feeling like he wanted to portray them, to satirize them. And I got
the most vehement letter I've ever gotten. I give out my email address at the end of the show. I got the most vehement letter at the end of the show I've ever gotten from a guy who simply felt that he felt two things, that this was not necessarily a suitable subject for a comedic film, and also that this film was described by, I think, one of the programmers of Sundance on the show as having being particularly powerful because it humanized its subjects. And I wonder how, and that was a positive thing in that Sundance guy's opinion and a positive thing in Chris Morris's opinion. But the guy who wrote to me said, you know, nothing can be good that humanizes a monster like a terrorist. And I wonder how your perspective on humor about something horrible, both Hitler and the Third Reich specifically, and more generally about the most horrible things there are and the most horrible people there are, how that's been informed by having spent these years doing this research.
Well, of course, you could reverse the argument and say that the statue, the way they wanted to be portrayed, is knocked down by humanizing someone. So you could actually reverse that and turn the argument around. So then the morality wouldn't be the question. The terrorists. I think humor is a way of dealing with trauma to some extent. You see countless examples of that from Simplicissimus, which was a manuscript, the first kind of German novel which came out of after the 30-year war, and where basically whole populations were wiped out. I mean, in this war, southern Germany was depopulated. And the first thing that comes out afterwards is about a young man who kind of stumbles through the war, and he's like a fool, and all sorts of weird and funny things happen. And it's just a sort of way of dealing with these things. You see that, for instance, in Forrest Gump, a very similar figure, which the film goes through all the American trauma of, AIDS, the Vietnam War, the 60s, uprising and so on, but seen through the eyes of a fool. So, I don't know, it just depends on, it's a coping mechanism, I think. And sometimes if something's too close to the events, it just does seem inappropriate to people. So that's why you're getting these kind of responses. For example, years ago, after September 11th, I used to be the assistant of Philippe Petit, who's a tightrope walk, and he did the walk between the World Trade Center. And I went to Ground Zero with him and talked to him on camera about what he had done, and I made a little film about it, and I wanted to expand on that, and it was impossible to raise money for it because people just couldn't see why one would make such a film at such a point in time. And many, many years later, Man on Wire came out on the same subject, and it was a huge success. But, you know, the timing was much better. People sort of saw that it was a poetic way of treating with the trauma. That just wasn't possible in the months afterwards. It was a miscalculation on my part.
The people require this kind of distance, whether it's the distance of time, the distance of, literal physical distance, whatever that distance is, they need something.
Yes, if you look at The Great Dictator, which incidentally, I mean, it came out in 1940. And of course, it didn't come to Germany. There was actually one copy which was taken out by the Reich Chancellery, so Hitler may have seen it. But apart from that, of course, no one saw it. There were rumors about it, but no one saw it. But then after the war, it took until the 50s, I believe even the late 50s, until it came out in Germany. And I read a review about the film, and a German review. And the reviewer said, the film is fantastic. Chaplin's a genius, but we're not ready for this. So that's, I think, quite resonant.
Well, Rudolf, thank you so much for taking this time to be on The Sound of Young America.
It's a great pleasure.
Rudolf Herzog's new book is called Dead Funny, Humor in Hitler's Germany.
That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I have been your host, Jesse Thorne. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer, Julia Smith. Our editor, Nick White in Chicago. Special thanks to Paul Ruest, who engineered our interview with John Ronson at the Argo Studio in New York City. If you have thoughts about the show, you can always email me, Jesse, J-E-S-S-E, at MaximumFun.org. If you want to download this show or any of our past interviews, you can do it for free at MaximumFun.org or in iTunes. Just search for The Sound of Young America. While you're at MaximumFun.org, I encourage you to check out all of our other programs, like the comedy advice show, My Brother, and Me, the comedy judge program, Judge John Hodgman, and my own comedy talk show, Jordan Jesse Go. They're all at MaximumFun.org, and they're all absolutely free. That's about it for us this time. See you next week on The Sound of Young America. Production of The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com.